Or is it? Or is it?
Childhood. The paradise to which we can never return. Ah, we love to hear stories of happy childhoods, don't we? No, we bloody don't. We want stories about misery, deprivation, suffering, rain pouring through the roof, only there wasn't a roof. And they want to tell us, the rich, the famous, the grand, they can't wait to tell us how they started with nothing. I once watched a DVD called Turn Your Life Around, made by an American life coach.
Hi, I'm standing in front of my 46-bedroom house in San Luis Obispo, California. Believe me, I wasn't born in a house like this. As a kid, I walked around with giant holes in my shoes. But I turned my life around, and I can help you do the same.
What's he talking about? You can't have a giant hole in your shoe. The hole would be bigger than the shoe. Miner's boots. Older than I am. They survived the Duncannon disaster of 1946. A fall of stone from the roof of the Duncannon pit killed 9 miners, including my father, Egg Wilson. I want to tell you the story of these boots. They are the part of my childhood I can never quite leave behind. The miserable, suffering, painful part. Wouldn't want to leave that behind now, would I?
I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows.
You're listening to Believe It, the radiography of me, Richard Wilson. This is my life story, acted out for your listening pleasure by a group of actor friends and myself. These are my secrets. You may think you know me, but you don't. In the 40s, everything was grey or brown. My childhood was like that commercial. You know the one with the baker's boy on his round pushing his bike up the hill to Omar Peggotty's place, and then his delivery's done, scooting back down for a doorstep of bread and a cup of tea with the kindly old baker. Think of the colours in that commercial. Even the bread was brown. My shoes had holes in them, but my mother, as you know, didn't have 2 pennies. They were brown to rub together. So, after my father died, she sent me up the road to Mrs. Smith's house. She thought Mrs. Smith might have something for me. Mrs. Smith was the widow of Jim Smith. Like my father, Jim was one of the miners killed in the Duncannon disaster. A nice man, Jim, one of those grown-ups who looked you in the eye, mainly because he was short. Jim was known as Wee Smithy. Nowadays, you'd call a man Wee Smithy because he was excessively tall, but this was the 40s. We were so poor, we couldn't afford irony. I stood on Mrs. Smith's doorstep practicing my speech. In those days, you never spoke to an adult without first rehearsing what you'd say.
Hello, Richard.
Good evening, Mrs. Smith. I'm so sorry to bother you at this difficult time when you're newly believed.
Bereaved?
Thank you. Can I start from the beginning again?
Of course.
Good evening, Mrs. Smith. I'm so sorry to bother you at this difficult time when you're newly bereaved. Mr. Smith was a fine man.
I know why you're here, son. Come in.
I knew this would happen. She'd lead me up the stairs to the bedroom, and there would be Wee Smithy's shoes. But I wasn't expecting Wee Smithy. He was laid out on the bed, dead, in his miner's uniform without his helmet. This was my first sight of a living, breathing corpse. He looked completely frightening. No, not completely. There was nothing complete about Wee Smithy, not after a pit roof had collapsed on his head.
He looks so at peace, don't you think? This is how I'll remember him. In his uniform, with his head on the pillow, half his head. Wee Smithy was a cheerful man. If he could speak now, he'd say, "My head's not half empty, it's half full."
Oh,
I'm so sorry, Mrs. Smith. I'll clear it up.
Oh, don't worry. Dougal, come here, boy.
I better go.
No, no, you've not got what you came for. Come on, Dougal. I'll get your shoes.
I stared at Dougal tucking into my sick. At least the dog lagged for nothing. Then I noticed Dougal had three legs. There was lack everywhere. Lack upon lack. Loss upon loss. Want upon want. How in the name of Scott's misery had the poor dog lost a leg?
You're wondering where his leg went.
No, no, no.
Wee Smithy came home from the pub on his bike. Dougal ran out to meet him. Front wheel broke his leg so bad it had to be cut off. Here, have these.
In her hand, she held Wee Smithy's boots. His miner's boots. She'd taken them off his dead body.
I can't take those.
They'll last you longer than shoes. Wee Smithy doesn't care. He's gone.
At this point, her son John came in. John was in my class at school. Poor John. He was a great big lad, bigger than his father. What John lacked was the power of speech. But I could see he was angry.
Mum! What's he doing with those boots?
I ran down the stairs and out of the house. Happily, it was raining. I looked up, opened my mouth and let the rainwater wash the barnacles of vomit from my teeth. Then I put on the boots and ran down the road, pounding the cobblestones. I was tearful with gratitude. Times were hard, but people were kind. All the grannies were on their knees, scrubbing their front doorsteps, showing their poor but proud working-class bottoms to the world.
Evening, Richard. You're in a hurry. Will you no come in for a macaroon?
I must get home, thank you.
Will you no come in for a macaroon? Did rich people say that to their neighbours? No, rich people didn't eat macaroons. They lived in castles with drawbridges and moats. They drowned their neighbours. I wore the boots for school next day. John Smith came over with Willie Thompson, the ugly brute who was my rival for Susan Miller's affections. But that's another story.
Hey, Wilson, what are you doing in those boots? They're his dad's.
That's right.
His ma gave them to me.
She should have given them to John.
They're too small for John. He's bigger than his dad was.
Yeah, they're too small for you, John, you great big idiot. Oi!
What you do that for?
Indeed. Who knows why Willie Thompson hit John Smith? You can't expect logic from bullies. John lay on the ground, sobbing. There were huge holes in the soles of his shoes, but he wasn't sobbing because of them or because he'd been hit. He was sobbing because the night before, his mother had thrown herself out of the bedroom window to join her beloved husband, Wee Smithy. Even though, given he was in the bedroom, it looked as if she was trying to get away from him. It was Dougal the dog that found her on the road, the very road where he had lost his leg. There was no luck on that road for Dougal. The following day at school, I didn't see John. That big, stuttering orphan boy had gone to live with his aunt and uncle in Canada. He didn't even go to his mother's funeral. I did, though. I walked into that church in his father's boots. By the new year of 1947, I'd outgrown the boots, but I never forgot them. Wherever I went, the boots went with me. At a lunch in 1984, I told the story of the boots to my old friend, Sean Connery. That very night, she threw herself out of the window. And you know who found her? Dougal.
Go on then, tell me more about your miserable childhood. Lunch is supposed to be entertaining.
Are you saying a man should forget where he comes from? You're a working class Scots boy too.
I am.
You didn't go to restaurants when you were a kid. You didn't eat monkfish and fennel.
I don't think they had fennel back then. I think it was invented in the 60s. You wore a dead man's boots when you were a kid. So what? Give them to charity or something. Then they'll do someone some good.
Swan was right. I had to get rid of the boots. I went home, got the boots, and donated them to an auction in aid of striking families. For this was the year of the miners' strike. The boots had come from a miner. Let them go to help other miners. I wrote to Sean and told him what I'd done. Then I went up to County Durham for the auction.
Lot 7 is a pair of miners' boots from the 40s, as worn in the Duncannon disaster. Who'll give me £50 for them?
£1,000.
£1,000, says the gentleman at the back. Mr. Connery, on behalf of everyone, may I say how grateful we are to you for giving up your valuable time to be here with us.
And so the auction stopped for 5 minutes while the auctioneer fawned over Sean. I was nauseated. He didn't deserve all that love. What was £1,000 to Sean? I decided to squeeze more out of him.
At £1,000, going once, twice.
£1,100.
£1,200.
£1,300.
£1,400.
£1,500. Hello?
Too much for me.
No, it's not.
It was destiny. The boots were meant to stay with me, to remind me of my duty to help the homeless, the hungry, and all those whose lives are stunted by poverty, their human rights to health and happiness denied. I know what you're thinking. Actors shouldn't do politics. Who wants to hear actors bang on about human rights? Unless it's the human right to do voiceovers or the right to do a panto every Christmas within an hour's drive from home. Actors too vain and self-serving for politics? Isn't that right? Too vain, eh? Too self-serving? Have you ever seen a politician?
Richard, I got your number from Sean Connery. I hope you don't mind me calling you.
11 years later, in 1995, I came home to find a message on my answer phone from Al Pacino.
Sean told me about your boots. The boots that belong to the dead miner? I'd be honored if I could see those boots.
Pacino was in England visiting Stratford and the Globe for his film about Shakespeare's Richard III, Looking for Richard. I invited him to my flat the following night.
Oh, they're beautiful. They have an aura, you know. Sean said they belong to your late father, right?
No, Connery gets confused. He's a bit older than us. It belonged to Wee Smithy, another miner who was killed in the same accident.
Do you mind if I try them on?
Be my guest. And so it was that Al Pacino walked round my Hampstead living room in those miner's boots.
Oh, yes, this is good. This is very good. Hoo-ha! You know how they make me feel, Richard?
Like a miner?
No, they make me feel dead. Dead as the ghost of Hamlet's father. I'm directing Hamlet off Broadway next summer. I'd be overjoyed if you would be...
I'm honored, of course. Thank you. It's a great part. I'll give it my all.
Oh, please, I don't want your all. Just the boots. I want to play the ghost of Hamlet's father in these boots.
Absolutely, of course. Actually, I'm not available next summer. I'm doing a panto. Summer panto. Hours drive from home.
I am thy father's spirit. Doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day, confined to fast and fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away. Yeah, great. Boots feel good.
Oh, you've got company. I wondered what the noise was. It woke me up.
Mummy, this is Al Pacino. Al, this is my mother, Maureen.
Good to meet you, Maureen.
I know you. You're Mary Poppins.
No, he's not, Mummy.
Yes, he is. You're Mary Poppins, aren't you?
Maybe. It was a long time ago.
It's definitely him. He couldn't do an English accent then, and he can do one now.
I'm sorry, Al. She was so nice in the old days, so inhibited.
You like a sing-song, Maureen?
Yes, I love a sing-song.
Okay, let's do this. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheree. Come on, Maureen.
A sweep is as lucky as lucky can be.
An hour later, he took the boots away. I was glad. They had an atmosphere. I don't mean a smell. I mean there was an aura of craziness around them. A year later, in the summer of 1996, I came home to find another message.
Richard, It's Al Pacino. How you doing? Listen, I'm making Donnie Brasco in New York with Johnny Depp, the Deppmeister. Hoo-ha. So Hamlet's not gonna happen. I get my assistant to send you back your boots.
Rats.
Please give my regards to your mother, a great lady. Long may she be with us.
The boots just wouldn't leave. They clung to me. And more people heard about them. People like the charming woman from the Sunday Times who came to interview me in 1997. Lynn Pearson was her name.
You're very caring. You care about your mother. You care about the Labour Party. You care about the theatre.
What is your question?
You're 10 years old.
I'm 61, actually.
No. I'm taking you back.
Oh, right, sorry.
You're 10 years old, and this is your experience of family life. A dead father, four sisters who share a bedroom with you, and a mother who makes you go to school in a dead man's boots. Is that why you never married?
I didn't want to marry her. She was my mother. It just didn't feel right.
Do you use jokes to keep people at a distance?
Well, I'm not...
You're a damaged person, aren't you? You feel pain, and I'm trying to find the source of that pain, and it's right there, isn't it? Inside those boots. Did the boots hurt? They hurt a lot, didn't they?
I wouldn't say a lot. Obviously, they were slightly stiff to
begin
with.
You wouldn't say a lot, but you'd think it. Isn't that right? There's so many things you think but don't say. Here you are, you're rich, you're a tremendous success, but all the time, inside, you're just this little boy who's hurting because he's having to wear a dead miner's boots.
The boots aren't that important, really.
They're right here in front of us on your kitchen counter. They're as important to you as your food.
They're only on the counter, so they're out of the way when the cleaner cleans the floor.
But they're in the way when she cleans the counter. It's all right to cry.
I'm not crying.
No, you're not, but you're so determined not to cry that I can't help but feel that you're absolutely crying your eyes out inside.
I don't have eyes inside.
Why are these boots so important to you?
I wanted to throw the bloody boots out of the window, which inevitably made me think of Wee Smithy's mother. And then it was obvious where the boots should go. To Wee Smithy's son. John Smith, that big, stuttering, hopeless boy, last seen heading for Canada nearly 50 years before. It was time to call Canadian Directory Inquiries.
Name, please?
John...
Can you spell that for me?
J for John, O for Orange...
Sorry, J for what?
What was the point? There were probably 10,000 John Smiths in Canada. Then, fate intervened, as it always does. That's its job. John Smith read the Lynn Pearson piece and wrote to me, care of the Sunday Times. He suggested we meet at the very spot where we'd last seen each other in 1946, in the school playground of Lady Margaret's school, Hamilton Road, Greenock. I agreed. As it happened, I was heading to Greenock anyway. It was April 1997, a month before the general election. I was going to Greenock to canvass for Norman Godman, the local Labour candidate, or should I say, New Labour. At 6 in the morning, I left my London flat, put the boots in the car, and drove 350 miles into the past. 9 hours later, I pulled up outside the playground. But the playground was no longer there. It was a car park now. Then I felt his hand on my shoulder.
Richard! John Smith! How are you today?
My God, is that you?
It's me, all right. Great to see you. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm sorry, I wouldn't have recognized you. You're...
What, American?
Well, yes.
That's me. I'm a Californian through and through. You can tell by the tan, right? We moved down from Canada when I was 12.
Right.
But I come to Scotland twice a year, more sometimes. I have a house near here. This is where I come from.
Well, it's changed a bit.
Our school's gone and our playground's now a Tesco car park. What does that tell you?
It tells me that if you have a dream, you can make that dream come true. And Tesco had a dream.
What had happened to the poor, stuttering boy whose shoes had even bigger holes than mine? An hour later, I was sitting in his 15-bedroom, chateau-styled villa in Helensburgh, on the south-facing side of the Clyde.
At 13, I looked at myself in the mirror and I thought, what am I going to do with this opportunity called life? Did you do that, Richard?
No, we couldn't afford a mirror.
Come with me. I want to show you the shiny room.
John Smith led me up the stairs, just as his mother had done all those years before.
When I found out I was worth $1 billion, I said to myself, John, it's time to buy yourself a house in Scotland so you don't forget where you started. On your butt, in the playground, beaten by a bully with your father and mother dead and giant holes in your shoes.
Yeah, they were big, I remember.
Goddamn right they were big. That's why I wanted an entire room with nothing in it but shoes. New shoes, without a hole between them. Welcome to the shiny room.
Goodness, they do look shiny. Except those ones.
They're suede. I turned my life around, Richard, just like you will. Come on now, turn around.
Well, literally.
Do it. Look me in the eyes and turn around. Come on.
I'm turning. This is me turning. Hello again.
This is what I do, Richard. I'm a success coach. I'm the founder and CEO of a corporation with offices in 94 countries. We turn people's lives around.
And what's your corporation called?
Turn Your Life Around.
That's good.
When I read that piece about you in the newspaper, I said to myself, there's a guy who's turning his life around. But here's the thing, you're not there yet.
No?
No, you're too attached to the past. You are literally holding on to my father's boots. In other words, you're looking behind you all the time, and a guy that's looking behind him isn't turning around. Am I right or am I right?
That was the moment to give him the boots, but it didn't. I didn't want to give him anything.
Listen, don't get me wrong. You've done great. I love A Foot in the Grave.
Thank you. It's not
that... You should be up there with Sean Connery. Say it to me.
What?
I should be up there with Sean Connery.
I should be...
Louder.
I should be up...
Louder!
I should be up there with Sean Connery!
Good. I felt that. What are you doing tonight? I'll tell you what you're doing tonight. You're staying here. We'll have dinner, just the two of us, because I'm in between wives right now. And then you and I will sit down together and watch Turn Your Life Around on DVD. What do you say?
I'd rather have spent the night in Guantanamo Bay.
Hi, I'm standing in front of my 46-bedroom house in San Luis Obispo, California. Believe me, I wasn't born in a house like this. As a kid, I walked around with giant holes in my shoes, but I turned my
It was a boxed set, you know, like The Wire, except I could understand every single word. That night, I couldn't sleep. I lay there thinking, I could sleep in 13 bedrooms. Why am I only sleeping in one? So I got up, but I didn't go to another bedroom. I went back to the shiny room, and the light twinkling from those toe caps did something to my brain. I went into the kitchen, found some bin bags, and half an hour later, gently, I tiptoed out of his house, leaving the front door on the latch, freewheeled down his drive, and drove off into Greenock. At 4 in the morning, I put all the bin bags on the doorstep of the Oxfam shop in Conway Street. Then I drove back, waited. At 6, I woke him up.
John, you had a break-in.
It's not possible. I got a security system cost me 70,000.
The shoes, they're all gone. The shiny room's empty. It's not shiny anymore.
He took the shoes? Why did he take the shoes?
I don't know. I didn't see him.
Those goddamn punks with their hoods, they got nothing. So they...
Stress made him stutter.
Take what...
I almost liked him when I heard that stutter again. Almost. The following night, I saw Tony Blair give an election speech in Gamble's Halls in Gourock.
This is from today's Greenock Telegraph. Margaret Austin, 58, manager of the Oxfam shop in Conway Street, arrived at work yesterday morning to find 207 pairs of shiny new men's shoes in black plastic bin bags, left there overnight by an anonymous donor. A man with too many shoes gives them away to help people who have none. The next time anyone says to me, Tony, why are you in politics, mate? I will pick up the Greenock Telegraph and say, read this.
I came out of the hall elated, proud that there was one man in this ugly world who'd give his own shoes to help others, even if that man was me and I'd stolen them. I walked to my car. Closer and closer I got to my car, and then I walked right through my car, because it wasn't there. While I was in the hall, listening to Tony, someone had stolen my car. Doubtless some goddamn punk with a hood who hadn't yet turned his life around. It was a hire car, so I didn't care. I just hoped they liked the boots. 4 days later came the bad news.
Hello, Mr. Wilson. This is Cheryl at Rainbow Rent-A-Cars. The police found the car. There was a pair of boots in the back, which I'll wrap up and send to you, because they're very precious, aren't they? I read in the paper your mum made you wear them when you was little. Oh, bless.
Last night, I Googled myself. We all do it, don't we? And I learned that I sleep with a pair of miner's boots by the bed. Then I went to bed. With the boots, of course.
Every time I hear a new...
You've been listening to Believe It, the radiography of me, Richard Wilson. I would like to thank my actor friends for their help in this endeavour. Lewis MacLeod, John Sessions, Jane Slaven, David Tennant and Arabella Weir. I'd also like to thank my ghost writer, John Cantor, and my producer, Clive Brill of Pacificus Productions, and our hosts, BBC Radio 4. One more thing. Every word you've heard is true. Or is it? Or is it?